Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Kimberly Brock, who is the best-selling author of The Lost Book of Eleanor Dare, which was shortlisted for the prestigious Townsend Prize for Fiction, and The River Witch, recipient of the Georgia Author of the Year Award. She is the founder of Tinderbox Writers Workshop and has served as a guest lecturer for many regional and national writing workshops. She now lives near Atlanta, and her latest novel, The Fabled Earth, just came out from Harper Muse. So welcome to Writers' Voices, Kimberly.
Hi, thank you. Glad to be here.
So The Fabled Earth is set in an island... Mostly, yes. An island in the coastal area of Georgia, correct?
That's correct.
And
yeah.
Is this how familiar are you with this part of the world?
Well, once you hear me start to talk, you'll know. You hear this accent. I grew up in North Georgia, in the Appalachian foothills of North Georgia, but my first beach trip. When I was a child, first time I saw the ocean, I was about 3 years old, was to St. Simon's Island, which is a barrier island off the coast of Georgia. My dad's best friend had a house there, and I can remember going down to the ocean with him on one side of me and my dad on the other side of me, both holding my hands, jumping me over waves. So very early, I was connected, and I'm very nostalgic about our Georgia coastline. He also gave the first Southern fiction novels to my mom when I was little. And I remember reading those books really early.
Like what books?
I think, you know.
Do you remember some examples of
They were the Eugenia Price novels about the Georgia coast. They were historical fiction. And then another novel I remember titled Cold Sassy Tree. So, you know, early I was reading these big chunky Southern fiction novels and historical fiction novels that made me ask a lot of questions about our history. And so I think when I started writing my novels, all three of my first books are set on the Georgia coast, but they're all connected to the North Georgia area and the Appalachian Mountains through characters. So I'm attempting, I think, to connect those two places and those stories and the way I feel about story and how stories connect us over time and space.
So in The Fabled Earth, why don't you kind of give a summary of what it's about?
So this is a dual timeline historical novel. It's set on Cumberland Island, Georgia, which is our southernmost island. It's now a national park. It's mostly undeveloped. But in the 1880s, the Carnegie family bought property there, not Andrew, but his brother Thomas and his wife Lucy. And they built a huge Gilded Age mansion. And then after Thomas died, Lucy continued to build houses on the island for her 9 children. So the backdrop is Cumberland Island in the 1930s, after the family has abandoned the first house, Dungeness Mansion, the largest house. And a young woman comes to Cumberland in 1932 who wants to live there as an artist in residence. And her grandfather was a folklorist, so she wants to do the same thing, and she paints. She tells some stories around a bonfire one night with some wealthy kids that are there, and things go wrong, and 2 boys drown. The second timeline is in 1959, when the only other girl that was there that night dies, and her daughter comes to Cleo Woodbine with questions about what happened in 1932. Cleo's been living for the last 3 decades as a recluse. She's got a lot of secrets, and Francis Flood is there to dig them up. And there's a third character. There are 3 POV characters who are all female. The third is a young woman, 19, 20 years old, Audrey Howell, who is an innkeeper in town. She's new to town. She's only been married a few months when she's widowed in a tragic accident. And she's come to run this inn, and she takes some pictures with her little brownie camera. And when she develops the roll of film, she accidentally develops an eerie double exposure photograph. And it has the face of one of the boys that hasn't been seen since 1932. So it's a book about mystery and folklore and how what happened in the past is now revisiting these three women and how it connects them in their lives and in this place in 1959.
So can you explain what double exposure means? What, you know,
it's so a double exposure happens when you, and I am not a photographer, my daughter is, so I had to ask this myself, when a negative has been developed twice, right, on the same paper accidentally, and you can do this on purpose, and you can repeat the process, which is something that Audrey Howell learns that she can do. But I had to ask my daughter, because I do remember using film to do this when I was a kid. It happening sometimes you would have your photographs developed and they'd come back and you'd have, if you have taken a photograph twice on the same film, exposed it twice, then when it's developed, both images will show up one on top of the other.
Okay, so it's the film itself is used again, essentially.
Twice.
Okay. Now, how can you repeat that?
That is something I am not an expert in. She explained it, and I used it in the novel. Know that if she didn't wind the film correctly, so it was already there in her camera, and you can do that again, and you can take the negative and do that again in the development process.
Okay. So Audrey, who knows how to do, or does it by accident at first, because she's using film that she's found in the freezer? Was the film in the freezer?
So a lot of times people will store their film in the freezer to preserve it. And so it has been in the freezer for a long time.
And so she thinks it's new film, but it's actually film that pictures have been taken on it before.
That's correct.
And so, okay, so she creates these pictures and by accident and then on purpose. Now, I'm curious about why, so the three point of view characters who are Cleo, who is the recluse on the island.
Yes.
Audrey, who's the young widow, and Franny, who's the daughter of the other girl. So, now, there are two other kind of important female characters in a way that, and one of them being Joanne, the mother. Well, basically, both Audrey and Franny's mothers are important characters in the story.
Right.
Why did you choose not to tell the story at all from their point of view?
Because I already have such a huge cast. People are already like, oh, wait.
Yeah, that's true. Notes.
I write about small towns, and so I end up having these large casts of people because everybody knows everybody. Everybody's family's connected in one way or another, whether it's through marriage or their cousins or, you know. So it's – and then I'm telling a story in dual timelines, so people know one another for generations.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a large cast in this very small town, and I felt like, if I'm considering story, and what I was really trying to talk about here is that the people that you're closest to, you never know everything about them, and in particular mothers and daughters. I tend to write about mothers and daughters in that way.
Mm.
I think all of my novels talk about your mother is the person who knows you the best and maybe a stranger to you in a lot of ways. And I also find it interesting that our grandmothers seem to have a different relationship with us as granddaughters. We are closer to our grandmothers sometimes and know more from them than we know from our mothers. Our mothers are our protectors, and our grandmothers are more like a peer. They tell us the secrets in the family. Your mothers tend to keep the secrets in the family.
That's I like that. And I have to watch that myself sometimes as a grandmother. not mm-hmm. to be telling the secrets that other people might not want divulged.
Yeah, we get brave the older we get. We start to throw everybody out and let them know what's really going on. Yeah.
It's I'm thinking about my own relationship with my parents now. As people who listen to the show know, I do the show with my mother.
Yes.
Some of the time. She's approaching 90, she'll be turning 90 next year. She's not up to doing it every week. And so she only does about one a month with me now. But but there are definitely secrets that I'm just that suddenly she is being a little more open with.
I don't know if it's because we're remembering things. You remember things differently as an adult, or just that your feelings change about it. If you feel like, you know, you're feeling the passing of time a little differently, and so your perspective on things changes, and your attitude about how long you have to make certain choices, right? What's going to be left behind when you're gone and what will be lost.
Yeah.
So all of those things are always in my mind when I'm writing about themes of mothers and daughters, but in a larger sense too, you know, about the community as a whole, about the country as a whole. I was looking at 1959. So there's social change going on, right?
Yeah.
But it's not the 60s yet. Things are just starting to cook.
Yeah.
And things are just starting. People are starting to lift their heads and look around and ask some questions and take note of things. And I think that's just part of the cycle in history that repeats over and over and over again, just like a mother-daughter relationship repeats over and over and over again. So I mirror those things a lot in the book.
One of the secrets that came out recently was because of DNA testing.
Oh yes.
And actually I'll share the story, because it has a very happy ending, where my son had been on ancestors.com or something, and someone had reached out to him and said, you know, I'm looking for my birth parents. Do you know I was born in XYZ and 1950 something, and do you have any idea? And we seem to be related. Do you have any idea who this could be? And he didn't know, and I just assumed it was his dad's side of the family because of where this was. But then later, Ancestry.com got more, they could give more detail, and they could tell you which side of the family it is. And so it turned out it was my side. And I'm like, well, it can't be from my dad, because they were all out on the East Coast, so it has to be from my mom, but she didn't have a big extended family. So I'm like, okay, what's going on here? So I go to my mother, and my mother only had one brother, and this is somebody who would be a first cousin to me. And I'm like, okay, Mom, is there a possibility that your brother fathered a child out of wedlock? And she goes, yeah, he did. Like, just like that. So after all these years,
I know. Isn't that funny?
Yes. And fortunately, even though I didn't really have any connection or contact with my uncle, and we tried calling and didn't answer and stuff, and my mother wasn't willing to talk to him about it. And so I was able to finally reach out to him through one of his sons that I also didn't have any real contact with, but I knew where he was. And so anyway, to make a long story short, this son had been trying to find his birth parents for 40 years. And my uncle was thrilled.
Wow.
My uncle was thrilled to find him.
That's fantastic.
I know. I was really happy about that.
And I love Ancestry.com, and I've done the DNA testing. I find it fascinating.
And
I love to looking at, I just like looking at the names and the places and wondering about people and how they got to where they were. I love to be able to find the documents that tell me how they got from place to place. And then imagining that. That's always been very compelling to me. I love to walk through cemeteries and look at gravestones, and I collect names from gravestones and dates and think about, you know, who were these people and how did they get here? Why are they buried here together? And where, you know, sometimes it's really interesting when people are missing from that picture and wondering where they've gone to and how they've gotten there. The stories are compelling, but they're tricky and they're not always true. My family had a wall of photographs and our family photo was in the center. And then my dad's side of the family, there were photos that went back to 10 types. And then on my mom's side, the other side of the photo was my mom's side of the family and went back to 10 types. And we could name a lot of the people. And I have all these photographs here in my home too. I like to look at them and talk about them. And the, you know, the stories that we have, I love the expressions. You wonder what's really going on in this picture. This lady with 10 kids, I know why she looks like that. That kind of thing. And then there's all the questions, you know, the stories that we don't know. I grew up with that appreciation for those things. I guess my dad really instilled that in me. And I just still enjoy thinking about that when I'm writing. I want to know who people are, and I want to know how they got where they are and why.
Now, have you put any of your family members into your books?
Oh, yeah. So my first novel, for sure, and I worried about it. I was younger then. See, I'm older now. I'm in my 50s now. I don't care anymore. But I was young, and I worried about it. And they're not explicit. It's more or less, it's, you know, pieces of things and impressions. And I worried, though, when it came out. And I will be honest with you. Every single time somebody that I'm related to reads that book and has said to me, "Oh, I know who that is," they are never right. Never.
Oh, and my goodness. Almost,
sometimes it's them. And I'll think, "No, you don't."
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Kimberly Brock, author of The Fabled Earth. Now, one thing, Southern writing has there's a long sort of history of Southern writing, and I think you've been compared to some of the well-known Southern writers. But one thing that I've noticed, at least about Southern writing today, is that racial issues are almost always a part of it, even if it's not the theme, but underlying.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it certainly is the case with The Fabled Earth.
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, it's an interesting topic to me because it always comes up, and it always comes up specific to being a Southern novel. I don't necessarily find that to be true. I think that is a topic for all novels anywhere. We have specific history here that is definitely problematic,
yeah.
To say the least, and tragic and sensitive. You know, people have their feelings. They get all in their feelings if you say this is a Southern novel about racial topics, especially if you're me, if you're a white woman trying to write about it. And here's what I say. I am a white woman that grew up in North Georgia in the 80s. What do I know about it? Mm. What do I know? Mm. Not much. A lot of it comes from what I've read. Important to be able to read stories about it.
Yeah.
A lot of it comes from conversation. And then I do have the experiences that I had, which were a step removed. I was in the 80s thinking, oh my gosh, how could this possibly have happened? I can remember like the very first time I was aware of segregation. We went to the library when I was little a lot because my mother loved to read. and we didn't have air conditioning, and the library had air conditioning. So in the summer, we would go to the library, and it was this big, beautiful old brick home with big white columns on the front in downtown. And it had an upstairs and big, you know, staircase, and I wanted to go upstairs, but you couldn't go upstairs. It was closed to the public, and I was little, and I kind of pitched a fit because I really wanted to go upstairs. And I remember my mom taking me out on the sidewalk out front to get on to me, and she told me, you need to calm down. You need to be grateful that you can come into this library, because I can remember when I was growing up, there were people who couldn't even come into this library. And I was, even at a very small age, stunned by that. The idea that somebody would tell you couldn't come into the library, and thinking, oh my gosh, what would I do? Because I loved the library. If I couldn't come into the library. And then as I got older, every time we would go, I would think, what would I do if I couldn't come into the library? How would I get in here? So,
and right, I don't want to give anything away, but that's a plot point in The Fabled Earth.
Same thing with our historic theater in town. I remember wanting to sit in the balcony when I was little, and my grandmother saying the balcony was closed, nobody went up there anymore, and her telling me her memories of who used to have to sit in that balcony and who used a side entrance. And so there's secondary, this is hearsay I'm learning, but I'm learning it from people that I love and who love me. And it was this confounding moment in my life to think, how was that okay? How were these people that I love, who are so good to me and I think are wonderful people, how is this okay? How did they just live with this? And it was all right. And so when I write about racial issues for my characters in these historical settings, I try and think about that, because I'm writing from a white perspective. They're not heroes. They're not necessarily making great choices. Sometimes they're accidentally making a good one. And they're in a moment where they're having to take a minute to question what's going on around them. That's really the best that I can do from my perspective, but I think it's important that I do it. I don't want to write a historical fiction where I don't look at what was actually going on historically. And the relationships don't necessarily have to be, it doesn't necessarily have to be about race. There are a lot of issues that I'm writing about in this book.
Well,
I'm writing about women's issues,
yeah.
As well, right?
yeah. So Cumberland Island, you said it's the southernmost island, and it's, did I see somewhere there, it's 17 miles long?
Yeah, I believe that's about right.
Yeah. And how did you find this history about the Carnegies? Is this something that everybody in Georgia knows, or is this something you kind of stumbled upon?
I guess, you know, I've always kind of been aware of it growing up, but I'm going to ramble a little bit here with a story, but it comes back around, I promise. I got married in 1996. I grew up on a farm. We got married in the backyard. The house was built. It was 100 years old. There was an oak tree that was 100 years old. We had about 25 people in folding chairs in the morning. I got married in a dress from 1912, the year the house was built. And then we were on a plane and out of there. It was quiet. It was sweet. It was small. So 3 months later, it hit the news, and we learned in Georgia, when everybody else did, that JFK Jr. and Carolyn Bessette had been married in a secret wedding on Cumberland Island. And I thought, oh, we're just like the Kennedys. That was so charmed, you know, we're nothing like the Kennedys. But somehow those two stories connected me to them, you know, in the way that stories do. And it became a part of my zeitgeist to know about that island and about why they were married there and what had happened there before. So I learned about the mansions at that point, and they stayed for their honeymoon at the Greyfield Inn. We'd been married 25 years and wanted somewhere fun and, you know, special to go to celebrate. And my husband made reservations at the Greyfield Inn for us. So we went, And we pulled up alongside the island, and it was quiet. You get there by ferry. You cannot drive on the island. There are some cars, people who live there. National Park Service has some vehicles, but for the most part, you're not in a car at all, not as a guest. And you take a ferry. There's a private ferry if you stay at Grayfield. So we were the only ones on the boat. And the oak trees with all the moss, you know, it's kind of spooky, quiet as we're pulling up. And I looked at the island and I realized it would have been their 25th wedding anniversary too, but they died in that tragic plane crash. So the idea of a ghost story came to me at that point. I knew I wanted to write a ghost story, and I looked at that island and I thought, well, this is the place. Mm-hmm. But knowing the long history of the island, because it goes far, far beyond the 1880s with the Carnegies. It starts with indigenous cultures, which, you know, I've kind of been aware of for my other novels as well, research that I've done there. And then colonization, you know, there were forts, there were battles, there were missions, Spanish missions, there are all of these things that have come and gone. Then long before you ever get to the plantations and the planters, and then finally the Carnegies. So there's all these iterations, these cycles of history going on this tiny little island that actually is sort of like the beginnings, the origin story of America. And I like delving through that and watching how it rises and falls and rises and falls, and thinking about that in terms of, you know, these are just the latest round of guys to plant their foot on this place. And really what every single one of those groups is doing is saying, mine, 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 and looking for home. This is my home now, not yours anymore. Now this is my home. That's our instinct as people to plant a foot and say, this is mine. And yet when you go there, that island totally belongs to herself still, I think. Yeah.
So the first Carnegie mansion was Dungeness, or how's that?
Dungeness.
Dungeness. Yes. Why was it allowed to go into disrepair so quickly?
Money, the lack of money. So it's the second version of Dungeness. There was a first Dungeness that was actually belonged to a British officer. And the Carnegies bought that, knocked it down, and built this house. It was not even finished when Thomas died, and Lucy finished the house. And then by the 1920s, they've abandoned it because everything had to be bought by boat. Nothing. I mean, the expense of keeping this place up out on this wild little spit of land that was totally undeveloped was extreme, extravagant expense. Mm. And so even for the Carnegie family, you know, once the robber baron money began to dwindle, yeah, it was challenging. So the kids decided, okay, we'll divide all the stuff up out of this big house and into our other homes on the island, and it was left. And of course, what happens when you leave a house like that for that amount of time on a barrier island where people have, you know, grown up for generations hunting and fishing and just scouting around. Now you have people saying, no, this is mine. Stay off my land. Stay off my property. So it became a contentious thing between the Carnegie family, in particular, one of that Lucy's granddaughters, another Lucy, who was the dominant matriarch on the island by the 50s. So there were shotguns involved, you know, and the typical stay off my land business.
Now,
and
did that Lucy,
the poaching is a real issue in this book.
Did that Lucy live there on the island,
yep,
like
she
year
grew
round?
Up in Grayfield. Oh. She grew up in Grayfield when it was her home.
Ah.
And then in the 60s, Grayfield became an inn.
Okay.
So, yeah. So she is present in the novel, and I make a mention of her, just a nod to her at Greyfield. Cleo sees her in passing, my fictional character. But she really did, the idea of her, because she was a stout little figure, and I was inspired around the edges for Cleo and Lucy, yeah. And so the poaching became an issue, and then in 1959, the big historical fact in this book is that Dungeness burned in a spectacular arson. And they never charged anybody. They were never sure who did it. But they speculated that it was some men that had already had some encounters, let's say, with the Carnegies. They think it was one of the poachers. So I got to speculate about that and have that big spectacle at the end of the novel. And, you know, if you're going to write a good, big Southern fiction, you burn down the house at the end, right?
And have a storm of the century.
That's true. It's absolutely true. Maybe it's the storm of the century. Maybe it's just big talk.
Because yeah,
I like that idea, too.
Yeah.
What we expect to come and knock us over and change everything, sometimes we survive it, and change is incremental, not what we expect.
Yeah. I was, one thing that kind of surprised me, because early in the novel, I felt like Cleo was almost alone out on that island, but there actually were a lot of people living on the island, and it was bigger than I expected to. My kind of vision of it at first was this, was much smaller, and that she was sort of alone out there. Now the other, what was the Johnsons? Were they real people, and the Piedmonts, are they real historical
the
figures
Piedmonts
as well?
Are not real. So the Johnsons are real.
Okay.
They did live at Plum Orchard. So Plum Orchard is the other house that features the Carnegie home on the island. It is huge. It's a big white elephant of a house. It's monstrous. And nobody lives in it now. It's part of the Park Service. You can go and tour it. That all of the homes did have the big indoor swimming pools that I mentioned, Plum Orchard and Dungeness. And Dungeness pool, they all do have the sulfur water in them. And the Dungeness pool did have the rings, the acrobat rings across the pool. So I did use, you know, some true fact in the book. And then the Piedmont family doesn't exist at all. They're just an idea out of my own head to represent who I thought would be coming to visit. And none of the kids, not all of the characters are fictional aside from the Johnsons. So Marius Johnson, Dr. Marius Johnson, actually did marry into the Carnegie family. He was the man of the house at that time. And his son, who you see later in the book, Maury Johnson, he is a true figure as well, and was coming to the island in the 50s to revisit his glory days at Plum Orchard.
So did you have any concerns about writing about him?
Absolutely. I mean, I did a lot of reading, and I don't want, I mean, listen, I have family stories that don't necessarily make us look like the heroes of our family stories, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think that they were that they're villains by any account.
No.
I think that they are people with money that are trying to manage a situation. And I thought that Dr. Johnson, by all accounts, he was a big storyteller, and everybody loved him. And I felt like I represented that fairly in the book, and in a really hard situation. He was doing what he thought was best for these young women.
Yeah.
And the kids, the men, the young men that are there, they're all kids.
Yeah.
So I think he does his best with the scenario. It is absolutely fictionalized. Then the idea that his son is still coming back and is kind of a sad figure is true to all accounts that I read. In fact, he did have a dog that he brought through the house and sent into all of the rooms, and then kicked out because he thought it would take the fleas. That is a story I read in a nonfiction account of him. So And he was a drinker. So that, you know, those are the things that I did put in the book that were real. And then I got to fictionalize it.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Kimberly Brock, author of The Fabled Earth. Kimberly, why don't you read a little bit from The Fabled Earth for us?
All right. So this is just from the first chapter, and this is Cleo Woodbine. Long before she took up as artist in residence at Woodbine Cottage, her grandfather had been the first to hold the post. The Carnegies of Plum Orchard had been his benefactors, those old gods with their wild fortune now dwindling away. Dooley Woodbine was a first-generation Scotch-Irish immigrant whose family had settled in Kentucky, and there he'd been a childhood friend of Marius Johnston, who later married Nancy Carnegie. When he'd invited Dooley to Georgia, Dooley brought his own wife, a practical girl from Brunswick, and his favorite Scotch-Irish folk tales and fables in his red head, like some people bring relatives who cling and settle too close. And while living in the cottage, he fathered his one son, Cleo's father, and written and illustrated a book of his own stories, Woodbine's Treasury of Glories and Grimms. There'd been 200 copies printed, and he'd kept only one, which he'd bequeathed to Cleo, along with his love of the shoals. Cleo herself had never traveled farther than the miles that separated Kingdom Come and the place where she'd been raised by parents who had worked in the mills and canneries of Reverie before both dying young, after the heartbreaking loss of their only son and daughter-in-law. Cleo's grandparents had left Woodbine Cottage and come to town to care for her, and only after all her family were gone had Cleo returned to the island, holding out just enough hope for her own future as an artist. She loved to sit on Dooley's knee and listen to him intone in the poetic language of ancient Irish myths and Appalachian ghost stories. He'd shown her a book of illustrations by Arthur Rackham, the artist who had most influenced him, and he'd gifted her with her own pen and India ink, a set of paints, and a fresh pad of special paper, and supplied new ones every year until he died when she was 10. She'd copied the illustrated characters in Woodbine's, filling up the pads of paper almost as soon as she received them. And then sometime after Dooley passed, her favorites of those characters took on a life of their own and began to tag along beside her. A friendly spirit named Little Hannah, a ghostly fiddler, and a lonely graveyard guardian, a dog known as the Grim. She'd only added to the canon once since she'd come to the shoals, a gentle giant who slipped through the deep forests and in and out of the light, whom she thought of as the spirit of the island. Dooley had said that all stories were ghost stories, an exchange of spirit between the world and the human heart that rode on an inhale and an exhale. Stories to Dooley were elemental, and Cleo couldn't have doubted that truth if she'd tried. She'd imagined all those stories he told drifting past her heart, slipping around the forest of her bones. It was no wonder the figments of her imagination trailed at her heels. They were good company as she loitered near Dungeness. Little Hannah stayed close as a shaft of that summer light, and the melancholy fiddle tune carried over the shoals. Serenade? Nah. A reminder she was not alone in her grief. Cleo was grateful for the ragtag bunch of childhood memories she'd dragged out here with her, and she'd continued to paint them so they might be remembered even after she was gone.
Thank you. That was Kimberly Brock reading from The Fabled Earth. So let's talk a little bit about your writing process. Now, particularly when you've got multiple timelines and multiple point of view characters, I'm curious about what order you write in.
So I typically think for a long time, I ruminate before I'm ever actually writing. And some of that process I do by hand. I like to write my way into the story. So I'll fill up like legal pads, those yellow legal pads, and I like to write with a pencil so I can feel it. And I'll start writing, and these scenes don't necessarily make it into the book. They're me trying to find the person, and I usually kind of know the place. And once I have a person in mind and I start to have a voice to that person, for whatever reason in my brain, I will then know the end for the story. I know what the story is about, how it's going to culminate. So I'll write the end scene, and it, you know, it'll shift and change through drafts to some degree, but mostly it holds up. That's the point I'm writing to. So I'll write that scene, sketch it out, and then I know where my story starts. So I'll go back to the beginning and I'll start with the first scene. And I write, like, I'll know, I don't outline heavily, but I'll know turning points in the story. I know I'm writing to get to this thing that has to happen, and then this next thing that has to happen, and this thing, and then the end. So I'll have a few major plot points worked out ahead of time. I always try and write in a straight line, and I think it's going to work. I fool myself every time, and I think, okay, I'm going to have like three characters, one main point of view, some secondary characters in this straight line. And then I start to write, and what happens inevitably is it will split into a dual timeline. And the reason it does this, I think, at this point, after three books, the reason I cannot help myself is because this is how I learned to tell a story. And when you grow up where I grew up, this is how your story goes. You start out telling the story, and then you say, but you remember when. Or you know about, and you have to reflect on something from the past. We like to talk about the past. And in families, in all families, we like to talk about the past. And so I think that's what happens. I get that far in my story, and then I say, oh, my brain says, but you know, I have to know where they came from, who they were, why they're where they're at. I want my characters to be wondering that. So I will inevitably have this event that happens in the past. And then my secondary characters, sometimes I just like them too much for them to just be a secondary character. They are giving me more information about the question that I have. In this book, the question was, I had said at a workshop that I believed all stories were ghost stories. And I thought, oh, that's so smart. What in the world do I mean? I don't know. But then I thought, do I really believe that? And I knew that I did. And I needed to figure out why. What did I really mean? What was that? And so each of the characters in this novel, in one way or the other, are haunted. And they're all asking that question. Are all stories ghost stories? And I'm getting my answers from them. So maybe that's why I end up with, you know, multiple timelines and multiple points of view, because I'm trying things out on these different, out of these different heads. I want to see what different answers I get for myself.
Wow. So, yeah, that's really fascinating. So you really do intend to write a single story about a single person?
I want it to be easy, and it never is. Never is. It's just how I think. It's how I process, I guess. And it's kind of embarrassing, you know? You would think you'd be able to write just a simple little story, but no. And sometimes it happens through the research, too. You know, something will... historically, a fact will come up that makes something really pressing and important. And so I think, okay, I really need to examine that. And I'm the best way to do that, the way to get the closest to that, is through this person or this timeline. And that was certainly true for this. And it was true for my second book too. I had a really hard time getting close to the one of the main characters is a colonial woman, a colonist. And although the history of this this novel is, you know, very linked to her and the mystery around her. As a person, she was really hard to connect to, and it was such, it was in such a distant past to me that I had a hard time with it. And I ended up, you know, writing other characters in the 1940s who could reflect on her and the meaning of that. And then her story ended up being more of a fable and not necessarily a straightforward fiction. So it, the story dictates it a lot for me.
So speaking of fables, so the title is The Fabled Earth. Why that title?
I knew I wanted it to have a reference to fables, folklore, because that's what the book is about. It's about the fables and the folklore of our family, the fables and the folklore of our community, the fables and the folklore in the larger scope of countries. And I like the way that those stories connect us, but also I wanted to think about how it can be dangerous to make heroes out of people who are not necessarily heroic. And so I wanted fable to be a part of the title, or folklore, and Taylor Swift beat me to folklore. And so really, I liked the word fabled. And I love writing. I think what I write is not a fable or a folklore, but more of a wonder tale. I always have an element of wonder in my books, even if you're dealing with the very real elements around you and very gritty storylines and people who are, you know, very grounded and connected to the world around them. And in particular, this book is, I feel that way with an island setting. It's very earthy, right? It feels marshy and humid, and that setting is atmospheric. So I wanted to connect the two elements, the idea of a fable, a dream that doesn't seem very real, that's very soft around the edges. If you go to Cumberland Island, it does feel that way. You feel like you've stepped outside of time. It does not feel like reality at all. You can't believe it's there. And yet, you are so grounded and connected to the earth. You are a creature of the earth when you are there. And so I wanted those two things to come together in this title. It represented the story and Cleo to me too.
Now, folklorist. Dooley was a folklorist, and that was Cleo's grandfather. And also Franny's mother.
Yeah, Frances.
And Frances is definitely a...
Yes.
Francine. Is it Frances or Francine?
Frances Flood. Yes,
yeah.
She studies folklore.
Yeah.
I thought it was fun because her mom is just fascinated with this story that's been passed down in her family from Germany, right?
Yeah.
And it plays a role in what happens in 1932. And so then that influences Frances to be obsessed with folklore and trying to figure out, why was this story so important to my mom? Why is this a thing? And I think we all have that in our families, you know, and
yeah.
It draws you to learn more about a certain thing.
So is that a real academic discipline, folklore?
Yes. You can be a folklorist, yeah. And I wish I had been. I think it would be a great thing to study. So I like the idea that, you know, it seems like this coincidence. Oh, how funny that you know, you have Cleo living on the island and her grandfather brought these folk tales with him just in his head, learned them as a kid, and wrote this little book and illustrated it. And that influence somehow has reached out to this person, Frances Flood, who seems completely unconnected, except for that brief period of time that her mother knew Cleo while she was on the island. And so now her whole life has been influenced by that one little story that they shared that night. And then now that's her life, was to study folklore. And so I think that is the power of stories. You tell a story and it has a life of its own, right?
Yeah.
And that is powerful. They're dangerous. They can be very dangerous. They can be inspirational, but they can cause some trouble too.
Yeah.
You never know what you're unleashing. Like, you might want to talk to your mom about what it is she's telling you about your family.
It's interesting because if I do question too much, she kind of shuts down. But yeah. and one
she
thing.
She has to think twice.
Yeah.
She knows.
Yeah. You know, these stories that are set in the 1930s and 1950s, and the young characters are behaving not that differently than my generation, your generation, my kids' generation. Mm-hmm. But we always have this idea that, oh, like teenagers didn't have sex in the 1930s or the 1950s.
Right.
Well, guess what? Yes, they
did. Yes, they did. Where do you think you came from? I know we all think we're the first to ever go through something, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse to do what I do with historical fiction, because I'm very aware of that. I'm very aware of the repetition of it and the cycle of life and generations. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about that. I spend a lot of time thinking about that, you know, in my own life with my kids growing up, watching my parents age. I think about it with our country and where we're at and what's happening all around the world.
Yeah.
But there is also some comfort in that, and that you're not the first person to go through this. This is not the worst time to live. It's not the best time to live. It's your time to live, and you do the best and the worst you can with it. And you hope that you move it as a whole in the right direction.
Well, you know, what you said about storytelling and how powerful and dangerous it can be, and I immediately flashed to our political situation and how much of that is a result of somebody who was a powerful storyteller.
This is true.
Yeah.
And what do you think, though, on the flip side of that, about stories that don't get told? The stories that are not told, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Are just as powerful and dangerous, and the consequences can be really sad. So, I mean, just the story you just told about your uncle,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
What could have been? Or what is now is, you know, kind of a miracle.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about all of those things and the repetition of the ideas of who can go into the library, who has access to what and when and where and what our freedoms are.
And now there's people who want to shut down libraries, don't think they're valuable.
So it's not new, and it's not...
It's a cycle.
Yeah, and it's not something that can't be overcome.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So I did want to ask you about Morning Glories.
Oh, yes, I am.
So,
Speaking of dangers.
Okay, so Morning Glories were always one of my favorite flowers. I used to sketch them on my, in school, I'd sit there and sketch Morning Glories all the time. And I, you know, they've always sort of been there, the corner of my awareness, but I didn't know they had hallucinogenic properties.
I didn't know it either. And I'll tell you, I can remember being really small, and I loved the flowers in my grandmother's property. We had a farm a mile down the road. We grew up right near my grandparents, and I would be down there on the weekends. And she hated that there were dandelions in her front yard, and she would go out with a hoe and dig them up, and I would beg her not to dig them up because I thought they were pretty. And then she had morning glories in her garden that would come up in the garden, and she'd go out with that hoe and dig up her morning glory vines in the morning. And I have a very vivid memory of one morning being furious with her because they were blooming, and I thought they were pretty, and begging her not to dig them up, and her saying, "They're going to choke our vegetable garden. We've got to dig these out of here." So I have this early relationship with morning glories. and also these vines, I think they were trumpet vines that grew on our fence line. And my grandfather would always get rid of them because he said if our cows ate them, it would make the cows sick.
Oh, wow.
So I knew about, you know, the fact that there were certain things you didn't want your animals, you shouldn't eat. I didn't know about morning glories specifically, though. And when I was looking for something for Cleo's grandfather, I wanted, Dooley talks about his paintings and he says that he has this, that they're magic, that people see what they want to see in them. He implies, you know, he kind of has, he's a visionary. So I knew that Cleo has this tragedy in her childhood that then gives her imaginary friends for a while, and they are the folktale characters. So I was playing with the idea of visions and artistic vision, as well as, you know, visions that are triggered by tragedy. And I didn't want Cleo to be a witch. I didn't want her to be that very typical character that, like, goes out in the garden and picks her rosemary and her lavender and, you know, and knows all of the things. And I just wanted to stay away from that. And I didn't want Dooley to be a cliche, drinking moonshine as an Appalachian man. You know, it's just so typical, right?
And it's real, been done. Yeah.
But I thought, what if, as an artist, you look for something, say you want to be a genius, but you're really not. So you need a little help. What do you go to? You go to something you know. Well, what could that be? So I went searching. I did research for plants, common plants that will cause hallucinations. And when I came up on morning glories, I thought, well, I'll be damned. Because it was so common, right? And so, like, that's the most benevolent thing I could think of, a morning glory.
Yeah.
And yet, here's this dangerous edge to it. It's beautiful. It looks like such a good thing. And yet, it can be really dangerous. And he uses that and abuses it. And I thought, what a beautiful metaphor. And then it's already named glory. And I, you know, I live in the South. It's a lot of glory being flung around left and right in the South.
Yeah.
And it's used in interesting ways.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I don't think I can do any better than that. Morning glory cities, who knew, right? It really does have the properties of LSD if you ingest it. And so
I don't think we need to let people know that.
Please don't drink your morning glory seeds. It's not the best plant.
Wow. Well, Kimberly, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. The Fabled Earth, it's very, like you said, Cumberland Island is atmospheric. Well, the Fabled Earth is atmospheric, too. You get
thank
in
you.
There and it's like you're in another world. And it makes me want to go.
I tell people
see
it's
it.
Slow and slow like barbecue, right? It's a nice long southern read.
Yeah.
I hope it makes people think, and I hope it makes them feel a sense of wonder when they finish it.
And I'm going to, we always close with the quote, so I'm going to read the quote at the beginning of your book from Zora Neale Hurston. Folklore is the boiled down juice or pot liquor of human living.
Yes, ma'am. You can always count on Zora.
Yeah. And thank you, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Thank you.